It was cheap in the colonies, so cheap as that a laboring man that understands husbandry can in a short time save money enough to purchase a piece of new land sufficient for a plantation. And if that man marries and has children, he and his wife could be confident that there would be plenty of land for their children, too. Franklin guessed the population of the mainland colonies to be about 1 million English souls, and his calculations suggested that this number would double every 25 years. At that rate, in only a century, the greatest number of Englishmen will be on this side of the water. Franklin's numbers were off. His estimates weren't too high. They were too low. At the time, more than 1.5 million people lived in Britain's 13 mainland colonies. Those colonies were far more densely settled than New France or New Spain. Only 60,000 French settlers lived in Canada and 10,000 more in Louisiana. New Spain was even more thinly settled. It was also more difficult, impossible, in New Spain and New France to separate out the settlers from the natives, since so many formed families together. In Britain's North American colonies, such unions were less frequently acknowledged, most kept actively hidden. Franklin, like many an American after him, lost his trademark equanimity when it came to the question of color. In Spanish America, a land of mestizos, slave owners commonly freed their slaves in their wills. By 1775, free blacks outnumbered black slaves. Something similar happened in New France, where the families of French traders and Indians were known as métis. Both there and in New Spain, people from different parts of the world married and reared children together over generations. Color in many ways marked status, but it did not mark a line between slavery and freedom. And color meant color, reds and browns and pinks and yellows. Britain's mainland colonies established a far different and more brutal racial regime, one that imagined only two colors, black and white, and two statuses, slave and free. Laws forbade mixed-race marriage, decreed the children of a slave mother to be slaves, and discouraged or prohibited manumissions. The owners of slaves very often had children with their female slaves, but they did not raise them as their own children, or free them, or even acknowledge them. Instead, they deemed them slaves and called them black. Franklin, reckoning with that racial line, added one more observation to his essay on population. He wrote about a new race, a people who were white. "The number of purely white people in the world is proportionably very small," Franklin began. As he saw it, Africans were black, Asians and Native Americans were tawny, Spaniards, Italians, French, Russians, Swedes, and Germans were swarthy. That left very few people, and chiefly the English, as the only white people in the world. "I could wish their numbers were increased," Franklin said, adding wonderingly, "but perhaps I am partial to the complexion of my country, for such kind of partiality is natural to mankind." Franklin stumbled over his partiality for people of his own complexion. Was it really natural? Perhaps. Plainly, he was troubled by it. But with his trademark alacrity, he wrote all this down, and then he moved on to another subject, the bonds that hold people together. Join or die. At the Albany Congress in 1754, Franklin proposed a plan of union to be administered by a president general, to be appointed and supported by the crown, and a grand council to be chosen by the representatives of the people of the several colonies, met in their respective assemblies. The union was to include the seven colonies labeled in his snake: New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, and the four colonies represented in the snake as New England, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, and New Hampshire. Franklin's plan apportioned representation for each of the 11 colonies in the Union according to the size of their populations, two each for sparsely settled New Hampshire and tiny Rhode Island, seven each for populous Virginia and Massachusetts. The government, meeting in Philadelphia, would have the power to pass laws, to make treaties, to raise money and soldiers for the defense of any of the colonies, and to protect the coasts. Delegates to the Albany Congress approved the plan of union and brought it back to their colony assemblies, which, fearing the loss of their own authority, rejected it. The British government, too, disapproved. As Franklin said, it was judged to have too much of the democratic. Franklin's plan of union failed. What lasted was the woodcut, which had a great deal in common with Powhatan's deerskin, stitched together a half century before. Join or die is, among other things, a map, but it's a particular kind of map, known as a dissected map. Dissected maps were the very first jigsaw puzzles, made by mapmakers out of paper glued to wood. One of the first dissected maps was called Europe Divided into Its Kingdoms, made in London in the 1760s by a mapmaker who had apprenticed with the king's geographer. It was a toy meant to teach children geography. It also taught children how to understand the nature of kingdoms and of rule. Franklin's Join or Die did some of that, too. It offered a lesson about the rulers and the ruled and the nature of political communities. It made a claim about the colonies. They were parts of a whole. Chapter 3 of Wars and Revolutions. Benjamin Lay stood barely over 4 feet tall, hunchbacked and bowed, with a too big head and a barrel chest, and legs so spindly it did not appear possible that they could bear his weight. As a boy in England, he'd worked on his brother's farm before being apprenticed to a glove maker, shearing and stitching skins. At 21, he went to sea. In his hammock by the light of tallow, he read books. Lay liked to call himself a poor common sailor and an illiterate man. But in truth, he was widely read and well-traveled. He sailed to Syria and to Turkey, where he met 4 men that had been 17 years slaves, Englishmen who'd been enslaved by Muslims. He swabbed decks with men who'd sailed on English slave-trading ships carrying Africans. He heard tales of dark and terrible cruelties. In 1718, Lay sailed to Barbados, where he saw people branded and tortured and beaten, starved and broken. He decided that everything about this arrangement was an offense against God, who did not make others to be slaves to us. Lay and his also-hobbled wife, a Quaker preacher with a crooked back, left Barbados after only 18 months and returned to England. Maybe it was something about being so bowed, so easily dismissed, so set aside, that left them reeling at the horrors of slavery, the breaking of backs, the butchering of bodies. In 1732, they embarked for Pennsylvania to join William Penn's Holy Experiment. In Philadelphia, Lay turned bookseller, selling Bibles and primers, along with the works of his favorite poets, like John Milton's Paradise Lost, and of his favorite philosophers, like Seneca's Morals, Essays on Ethics by an Ancient Roman Stoic. He traveled from town to town and from colony to colony, only ever on foot. He would not spur a horse, to denounce slavery before governors and ministers and merchants. "What a parcel of hypocrites and deceivers we are," he said. His arguments fell on deaf ears. After his wife died, he lost his last restraint. In 1738, he went to a Quaker meeting in New Jersey, carrying a Bible whose pages he'd removed. He'd placed inside the book a pig's bladder filled with pokeberry juice, crimson red. "Oh, all you Negro masters who are contentedly holding your fellow creatures in a state of slavery," he cried, entering the meeting house. "You who profess to do unto all men as ye would they should do unto you, you shall see justice in the sight of the Almighty, who beholds and respects all nations and colors of men with an equal regard." Then, taking his Bible from his coat and a sword from his belt, he pierced the Bible with the sword. To the stunned parishioners, it appeared to burst with blood, as if by miracle, spattering their heads and staining their clothes as Lay thundered from his tiny frame, "Thus shall God shed the blood of those persons who enslave their fellow creatures." The next month, Benjamin Franklin printed Lay's book, All Slave Keepers That Keep the Innocent in Bondage, Apostates, a rambling and furious 300-page polemic. Franklin sold the book at his shop, 2 shillings a copy, 20 shillings a dozen. Lay handed out copies for free. Then he became a hermit. Outside of Philadelphia, he carved a cave out of a hill. Inside, he stowed his library, 200 books of theology, biography, poetry, and history. He decided to protest slavery by refusing to eat or drink or wear or use anything that had been made with forced labor. He also refused to eat animals. He lived on water and milk, roasted turnips and honey. He kept bees and spun flax and stitched clothes. Franklin used to visit him in his cave. Franklin, at the time, owned a Negro boy named Joseph. By 1750, he also owned 2 more slaves, Peter and Jemima, husband and wife. Lay pressed him and pressed him. By what right? Franklin, himself a runaway, knew, as every printer knew and every newspaper reader knew, that every newspaper contained within its pages tales of revolution and the stories of everyday escapes. Among them in those years were the following. Bet, who had a large scar on her breast, ran away in 1750 from a man on Long Island. She was wearing nothing but a petticoat and a jacket in the bitter cold of January. Primus, who was 37 and missing the first joint of one of his big toes, probably a punishment for an earlier attempted escape, ran away from Hartford in 1753, carrying his fiddle. Jack, a tall, slim fellow, very black, and speaks good English, left Philadelphia in July of 1754. Sam, a carpenter 30, a dark mulatto, ran away from a shop in Prince George's County, Maryland, in the winter of 1755. He is supposed to be lurking in Charles County, his owner wrote, where a mulatto woman lives, whom he has for some time called his wife, but as he is an artful fellow and can read and write, it is probable he may endeavor to make his escape out of the province. Will, 40, ran away from a plantation in Virginia in the summer of 1756. He was, his owner said, much scarred on his back with a whip. When Benjamin Franklin began writing his autobiography in 1771, he turned the story of his own escape, running away from his apprenticeship to his brother James, into a metaphor for the colony's growing resentment of parliamentary rule. James's harsh and tyrannical treatment, Franklin wrote, had served as a means of impressing me with that aversion to arbitrary power that has stuck to me through my whole life. But that was also the story of every runaway slave ad, testament after testament to an aversion to arbitrary power. In April 1757, before sailing to London, Franklin drafted a new will in which he promised Peter and Jemima that they would be freed at his death. 2 months later, when Franklin reached London, he wrote to his wife, Deborah, "I wonder how you came by Benjamin Lay's picture." She had hung on the wall an oil portrait of the dwarf hermit standing outside his cave, holding in one hand an open book. The American Revolution did not begin in 1775, and it didn't end when the war was over. The success of Mr. Lay in sowing the seeds of a revolution in morals, commerce, and government in the new and in the old world should teach the benefactors of mankind not to despair if they do not see the fruits of their benevolent propositions or undertakings during their lives, Philadelphia Dr. Benjamin Rush later wrote. Rush signed the Declaration of Independence and served as a Surgeon General of the Continental Army. To him, the revolution began with the seeds sown by people like Benjamin Lay. Some of these seeds produced their fruits in a short time, Rush wrote, but the most valuable of them, like the venerable oak, are centuries in growing. In 1758, when Benjamin Lay's portrait hung in Benjamin Franklin's house, the Philadelphia Quaker meeting formally denounced slave trading. Quakers who bought and sold men were to be disavowed. When Lay heard the news, he said, "I can now die in peace," closed his eyes, and expired. Within the year, another Pennsylvania Quaker, Anthony Benezet, published a little book called Observations on the Enslaving, Importing, and Purchasing of Negroes, in which he argued that slavery was inconsistent with the gospel of Christ, contrary to natural justice and the common feelings of humanity, and productive of infinite calamities. Bet and Primus and Jack and Sam and Will had not run away for nothing. There were not one but two American revolutions at the end of the 18th century, the struggle for independence from Britain and the struggle to end slavery. Only one was won. 1. Benjamin Franklin wrote a new will before he sailed to London in 1757 because Britain and France were attacking each other's ships and he feared his might get sunk. The fighting had broken out 3 years before, only weeks after Franklin printed his join or die snake slithering across a page. The battling had begun not at sea, but on land, in Franklin's own colony of Pennsylvania. Britain sorely wanted land that the French had claimed in the Ohio Valley, complaining, "The French have stripped us of more than 9 parts in 10 of North America and left us only a skirt of coast along the Atlantic shore." Leaving that skirt behind, English settlers had begun advancing farther and farther inland, into territories occupied by native peoples, but claimed by France. To stop them, the French had started building forts along their borders. The inevitable skirmish came in May 1754, when a small force of Virginia militiamen and their Indian allies led by a 21-year-old Lieutenant Colonel George Washington, ambushed a French camp at the bottom of a glen. Born in 1732 in Westmoreland County, Virginia, Washington had inherited his first human property at the age of 10, traveled to the West Indies as a young man, and accepted his first military commission at the age of 20. Tall, imposing, and grave, he cut a striking figure. He was as yet inexperienced, and his first battle proved disastrous for the Virginians, who retreated to a nearby meadow and hastily erected a small wooden garrison that they named, suitably, Fort Necessity. After losing a third of his men in a single day, like so many stalks of wheat hacked down by a scythe, the young lieutenant surrendered. Only weeks later, delegates from the colonies met in Albany to consider Franklin's proposal to form a defensive union, and though they approved the plan, their colonial assemblies rejected it. The war came all the same, a war over trade in the East Indies, over fishing rights off the coast of Newfoundland, over shipping along the Mississippi River, and over sugar plantations on the West Indian Islands. Like all wars, its costs were borne most heavily by the poor, who did the fighting, while traders who sold weapons and supplied soldiers saw profits. "War is declared in England, universal joy among the merchants," wrote one New Yorker in 1756. The colonists called it the French and Indian War, after the people that were fighting in North America, but the war stretched from Bengal to Barbados, drew in Austria, Portugal, Prussia, Spain, and Russia, and engaged armies and navies in the Atlantic and the Pacific and the Mediterranean and the Caribbean. The French and Indian War did what Franklin's woodcut could not. As far north as New England, it brought Britain's North American colonies together. Not least, it also led to the publication of an American magazine, printed in Philadelphia and sent to subscribers from Jamaica to Boston. As its editors boasted, "Our readers are a numerous body, consisting of all parties and persuasions through British America." During earlier wars between the British and the French, the colonists had mostly done their own fighting, raising town militias and provincial armies. But in 1755, Britain sent regiments of its regular army to North America under the command of the stubborn and tempestuous General Edward Braddock. Franklin viewed the appointment of Braddock as the Crown's attempt to keep the colonies weak. The British government, not choosing to permit the union of the colonies as proposed at Albany, and to trust that union with their defense lest they should thereby grow too military, he wrote, they sent over General Braddock with two regiments of regular English troops. Charged with moving the French line, Braddock began to prepare to engage the French at Fort Duquesne, at the mouth of the Ohio River on the western edge of the frontier. Franklin warned the general that his planned route, as serpentine as a snake's path, would expose his troops to Indian attack. "The slender line, near 4 miles long, which your army must make," he explained, "may expose it to attack by surprise in its flanks and to be cut off like a thread in several pieces." Braddock, it would seem, gave Franklin a condescending smile, the same smile the king gave his subjects. "These savages may indeed be a formidable enemy to your raw American militia," he said, "but upon the king's regular and disciplined troops, sir, it is impossible they should make any impression." Braddock and his troops proceeded with their march. Along the way, they plundered the people. Before long, many colonists found themselves fearing the British army as much as the French. "This was enough to put us out of conceit of such defenders if we really had wanted any," wrote Franklin bitterly. Braddock's troops were ignominiously defeated, and Braddock was shot. During a beleaguered retreat, the dying general was carried off the field by Washington. Nothing daunted, William Pitt, the new Secretary of State, determined to win the war and settle Britain's claims in North America once and for all. In his honor, when the British and American troops finally seized Fort Duquesne, they renamed it Fort Pitt. But Pitt's lasting legacy would lie in the staggering cost of the war. Before long, 45,000 troops were fighting in North America. Half were British soldiers, half were American troops. Pitt promised the colonies the war would be fought at His Majesty's expense. It was the breaking of that promise and the laying of new taxes on the colonies that would in the end lead the colonists to break with England. Even before then, the most expensive war in history cost Britain the loyalty of its North American colonists. British troops plundered colonial homes and raided colonial farms. Like Braddock, they also sneered at the ineptness of colonial militias and provincial armies. In close quarters, in camps, and on marches, few on either side failed to notice the difference between British and American troops. The British found the colonists inexpert, undisciplined, and unruly. But to the Americans, few of whom had ever been to Britain, it was the British who were wanting, lewd, profane, and tyrannical. A clash proved difficult to avoid. In the British Army, rank meant everything. British officers were wealthy gentlemen, and enlisted men were drawn from the masses of the poor. In the colonial forces, there were hardly any distinctions of rank. In Massachusetts, one in every three men served in the French and Indian War, whether they were penniless clerks or rich merchants. In any case, differences of title and rank that existed in Britain did not exist in the colonies, at least among free men. In England, fewer than one in five adult men could vote. In the colonies, that proportion was two-thirds. The property requirements for voting were met by so many men that Thomas Hutchinson, who lost a bid to become governor in 1749, complained that the town of Boston was an absolute democracy. "There is more equality of rank and fortune in America than in any other country under the sun," South Carolina Governor Charles Pinckney declared. This was true, so long as no one figured in that calculation, as Pinckney never would, people who were property, a number that included Pinckney's 45 slaves at Snee Farm, 55 people who constituted the source of his family's wealth. Among them were Cyrus, a carpenter, valued by Pinckney at 120 pounds, Cyrus's children Charlotte, 80 pounds, Sam, 40 pounds, and Bella, 20 pounds, his granddaughter Kate, 70 pounds, and a very old woman named Joan, who might have been Cyrus's mother. Pinckney placed the value of this great-grandmother at zero. She was to him worthless. In 1759, British and American forces defeated the French in Quebec, a stunning victory that led the Iroquois to abandon their long-standing position of neutrality and join with the English, which turned the tide of the war. In August 1760, the English captured Montreal, and the North American part of the war ended, only 600 miles from where it began, at the ragged western edge of the British Empire. Weeks later, young George III was crowned King of Great Britain. 22 and strangely shy, he was a boy of a man, dressed in gold, his white buckled shoes tripping on a train of ermine. He presented himself to an uneasy world as a defender of the Protestant faith and of English liberties. He had declared, as Prince of Wales, "The pride, the glory of Britain, and the direct end of its constitution is political liberty." But by now, while his subjects in North America welcomed the coronation of their new king, they might easily have recalled the wisdom of a proverb that Franklin had printed 20 years earlier in Poor Richard's Almanac. "The greatest monarch on the proudest throne is obliged to sit upon his own arse." Mapmakers sharpened their quills to redraw the map of North America when peace was reached in 1763. Under its terms, France ceded Canada and all of New France east of Mississippi to Britain. France granted all its lands to the west of the Mississippi, territory known as Louisiana, to Spain, and Spain yielded Cuba and half of Florida to Britain. Britain's skirt of settlement along the Atlantic looked now like bolts of fabric unfurled on the dressmaker's floor. "We in America have certainly abundant reason to rejoice," the leading Massachusetts lawyer, James Otis Jr., wrote from Boston in 1763. "The British dominion and power may now be said literally to extend from sea to sea and from the great river to the ends of the earth." If the war had strained the colonists' relationship to the empire, the peace had strengthened both the empire and the colonists' attachment to it. Added Otis, "The true interests of Great Britain and her plantations are mutual, and what God in his providence has united, let no man dare attempt to pull asunder." But the war had left Britain nearly bankrupt. The fighting had nearly doubled Britain's war debt, and Pitt's promise began to waver. Then, too, the king's ministers determined that defending the empire's new North American borders would require 10,000 troops or more, especially after a confederation of Indians led by an Ottawa chief named Pontiac captured British forts in the Great Lakes and Ohio River Valley. Pontiac, it was said, had been stirred to action by a prophecy of the creation on earth of a heaven where there was no white people. Fearing the cost of suppressing more Indian uprisings, George III issued a proclamation decreeing that no colonists could settle west of the Appalachian Mountains, a line that many colonists had already crossed. In 1764, to pay the war debt and fund the defense of the colonies, Parliament passed the American Revenue Act, also known as the Sugar Act. Up until 1764, the colonial assemblies had raised their own taxes. Parliament had regulated trade. When Parliament passed the Sugar Act, which chiefly required stricter enforcement of earlier measures, some colonists challenged it by arguing that because the colonies had no representatives in Parliament, Parliament had no right to levy taxes on them. The Sugar Act wasn't radical. The response to it was radical, a consequence of the growing power of colonial assemblies at a time when the idea of representation was gaining new force. Taxes are what people pay to a ruler to keep order and defend the realm. In the ancient world, landowners paid in crops or livestock, the landless with their labor. Levying taxes made medieval European monarchs rich. Only in the 17th century did monarchs begin to cede the power to tax to legislatures. Taxation became tied to representation at the very time that England was founding colonies in North America and the Caribbean, which was also the moment at which England had begun to dominate the slave trade. In the 1760s, the two became muddled, rhetorically. Massachusetts Assemblyman Samuel Adams asked, "If taxes are laid upon us in any shape without our having a legal representation where they are laid, are we not reduced from the character of free subjects to the miserable state of tributary slaves?" Taxation without representation, men like Adams argued, is rule by force, and rule by force is slavery. This argument had to do in part with debt. The borrower is a slave to the lender, as Franklin once put it in Poor Richard's Almanac. Debtors could be arrested and sent to debtor's prison. Debtor's prison was far more common in England than in the colonies, which were in many ways debtor's asylums. But if there was an unusual tolerance for debt in the colonies, there was also an unusual amount of it. And in the 1760s, there was, suddenly, rather a lot more of it. The governor of Massachusetts reported that a stop to all credit was expected, and even a general bankruptcy. The end of the French and Indian War led to a contraction of credit, followed by a crippling depression, and especially in the South, several years of poor crops. Tobacco plantation owners in the Chesapeake found themselves heavily indebted to merchants in England, who, themselves strapped, were quite keen to collect those debts. These planters, in particular, found it politically useful to describe themselves as slaves to their creditors. During these same years, though, the sugar colonies in the Caribbean prospered, not least because the Sugar Act enforced a monopoly. Under its terms, colonists on the mainland had to buy their sugar from the British West Indies. This difference did not pass unobserved. Our tobacco colonies send us home no such wealthy planters as we see frequently arrive from our sugar islands, Adam Smith would remark in The Wealth of Nations. Parliament's next Revenue Act induced a still more strenuous response. A 1765 Stamp Act required placing government-issued paper stamps on all manner of printed paper, from bills of credit to playing cards. Stamps were required across the British Empire, and by those standards, the tax levied in the colonies was cheap. Colonists paid only two-thirds of what Britons paid. But in the credit-strained mainland colonies, this proved difficult to bear. Opponents of the Act began styling themselves the Sons of Liberty, after the Sons of Liberty in 1750s Ireland, and describing themselves as rebelling against slavery. A creditor was lord of another man's purse. Hadn't British creditors and Parliament itself swindled North American debtors of their purses and their liberty too? Was not Parliament making them slaves? John Adams, a 29-year-old Boston lawyer and leader of the Stamp Act opposition, wrote, "We won't be their Negroes." The colonies were bound up in a growing credit crisis that would engulf the whole of the British Empire, from Virginia planters to Scottish bankers to East India Company tea exporters. But there were American particulars, too. With the Stamp Act, a tax on all printed paper, including newspapers, Parliament levied a tax that cost the most to the people best able to complain about it, the printers of newspapers. "It will affect printers more than anybody," Franklin warned, begging Parliament to reconsider. Printers from Boston to Charleston argued that Parliament was trying to reduce the colonists to a state of slavery by destroying the freedom of the press. The printers of the Boston Gazette refused to buy stamps and changed the paper's motto to, "A free press maintains the majesty of the people." In New Jersey, a printer named William Goddard issued a newspaper called The Constitutional Current, with Franklin's segmented snake on the masthead. This time, asked whether to join or die, the colonies decided to join. In October, the month before the Stamp Act was to take effect, 27 delegates from 9 colonies met in a Stamp Act Congress in New York City Hall, where John Peter Zenger had been tried in 1735 and Caesar in 1741. The Stamp Act Congress collectively declared that it is inseparably essential to the freedom of a people and the undoubted right of Englishmen that no taxes be imposed on them but with their own consent given personally or by their representatives. When they dined, they sent their leftovers to the debtors confined in a prison in the building's garret, making common cause with men deprived of their liberty by creditors. The sovereignty of the people, the freedom of the press, the relationship between representation and taxation, debt as slavery, each of these ideas with origins in England found a place in the colonists' opposition to the Stamp Act. Still, Parliament professed itself baffled. In 1766, Benjamin Franklin appeared before the House of Commons to explain the colonists' refusal to pay the tax. At 60, Franklin presented himself as at once a man of the world and an American provincial, wily and plain-spoken, sophisticated and homespun. "In what light did the people of America used to consider the Parliament of Great Britain?" the ministers asked. "They considered the Parliament as the great bulwark and security of their liberties and privileges, and always spoke of it with an utmost respect and veneration," was Franklin's reply. "And have they not still the same respect for Parliament?" "No, it is greatly lessened." If the colonists had lost respect for Parliament, why had this come to pass? On what grounds did they object to the stamp tax? There was nothing in Pennsylvania's charter that forbid Parliament from exercising this authority. "It's true," Franklin admitted. "There was nothing specifically to that effect in the colony's charter." He cited instead their understanding of the common rights of Englishmen as declared by Magna Carta, as if the colonists were the barons of Runnymede, King George their King John, and Magna Carta their constitution. "What used to be the pride of the Americans?" Parliament wanted to know. "To indulge in the fashions and manufactures of Great Britain. What is now their pride?" "To wear their old clothes over again until they can make new ones." Here was poor Richard again with his proverbs. And yet this defiance did not extend to Quebec or to the Sugar Islands, where the burden of the stamp tax was actually heavier. 13 colonies eventually cast off British rule. Some 13 more did not. Colonists from the mainland staged protests, formed a Congress, and refused to pay the stamp tax. But except for some vague and half-hearted objections expressed on Nevis and St. Kitts, British planters in the West Indies barely uttered a complaint. South Carolina, whose economy had more in common with the British West Indies than with the mainland colonies, wavered. They were too worried about the possibility of inciting yet another slave rebellion. On the mainland, whites outnumbered blacks 4-1. On the islands, blacks outnumbered whites 8-1. One quarter of all British troops in British America were stationed in the West Indies, where they protected English colonists from the ever-present threat of slave rebellion. For this protection, West Indian planters were more than willing to pay a tax on stamps. Planters in Jamaica were still reeling from the latest insurrection in 1760, when an Akan man named Tacky had led hundreds of armed men who burned plantations and killed some 60 slave owners before they were captured. The reprisals had been ferocious. Tacky's head was impaled on a stake, and as in New York in 1741, some of his followers were hung in chains, while others were burned at the stake. And still the rebellions continued, for which island planters began to blame colonists on the mainland. Did the Sons of Liberty realize what they were saying? "Can you be surprised that the Negroes in Jamaica should endeavor to recover their freedom?" one merchant fumed, "when they daily hear at the tables of their masters how much the Americans are applauded for the stand they are making for theirs?" Unsurprisingly, the island planters' unwillingness to join the protest against the Stamp Act greatly frustrated the Sons of Liberty. "Their Negroes seem to have more of the spirit of liberty than they," John Adams complained, asking, "Can no punishment be devised for Barbados and Port Royal in Jamaica?" Adams was the rare man whose soaring ambition matched his talents. He would learn to restrain his passions better, but in the 1760s, his anger at those who refused to support the resistance was unchecked. The punishment the Sons of Liberty decided upon came in the form of a boycott of Caribbean goods. In language even more heated than Adams's, patriot printers damned the slavish islands of Barbados and Antigua, poor, mean-spirited, cowardly, dastardly Creoles, for their base desertion of the cause of liberty, their tame surrender to the rights of Britons, their mean, timid resignation to slavery. Planters bridled at the attack and floundered under the effects of the boycott. "We are likely to be miserably off for want of lumber and northern provisions," one Antigua planter wrote, "as the North Americans are determined not to submit to the Stamp Act." But they did not yield, and some began to consider their northern neighbors to be mere blusterers.
I look on them as dogs that will bark but dare not stand, complained one planter from Jamaica. Nor were the West Indian planters wrong to worry that one kind of rebellion would incite another. In Charleston, the Sons of Liberty marched through the streets chanting, "Liberty and no steps!" only to be followed by slaves crying, "Liberty! Liberty!" And not a few Sons of Liberty made the same leap, from fighting for their own liberty to fighting to end slavery. The colonists are, by law of nature, freeborn, as indeed are all men, white or black, James Otis Jr. insisted in a searing tract called Rights of the British Colonists Asserted, published in 1764, only months after he had rejoiced about the growth of Britain's empire. Brilliant and unstable, Otis would later lose his mind. Before his death in 1783, when he was struck by lightning, he had taken to running naked through the streets. But in the 1760s, he, better than any of his contemporaries, saw the logical extension of arguments about natural rights. He found it absurd to suggest that it could be right to enslave a man because he is black, or because he has short, curled hair like wool. Slavery, Otis insisted, is the most shocking violation of the law of nature, and a source of political contamination, too. Those who every day barter away other men's liberty will soon care a little for their own, he warned. Otis's readers picked and chose which parts of his treatise to hold close, and which parts to shed. But something had been set loose in the world, a set of unruly ideas about liberty, equality, and sovereignty. In 1763, when Benjamin Franklin visited a school for black children, he admitted that his mind had changed. "I have conceived a higher opinion of the natural capacities of the black race than I have ever before entertained," he wrote a friend. In Virginia, George Mason began to have doubts about slavery, sending to George Washington in December of 1765 an essay in which he argued that slavery was the primary cause of the destruction of the most flourishing government that ever existed, the Roman Republic, and warning that it might be the destruction of the British Empire, too. Debt, taxes, and slavery weren't the only issues raised in the political debates of the 1760s. The intensity of the debate strengthened new ideas about equality, too. "Male and female are all one in Christ the truth," Benjamin Lay had argued, expressing an idea that drew on a wealth of 17th-century Quaker writings about spiritual equality. "Are not women born as free as men?" Otis asked. Even Benjamin Franklin's long-suffering sister Jane began to entertain this notion. In 1765, Jane Franklin lost her husband, a saddler and ne'er-do-well named Edward Meekham, who had sickened while in debtor's prison, and she began taking in, as boarders, members of the Massachusetts Assembly. "I do not pretend to write about politics," she once wrote to her brother, "though I love to hear about them." This was false modesty, a fishing for commendation about which her brother so often chided her. At her table there was a lot for her to listen to when, in 1766, Otis was elected as Speaker of the Massachusetts Assembly, but the royally appointed governor refused to accept the results of the election. If Jane Franklin wasn't as yet willing to write about politics, she had heard much worth pondering. Not long after the governor overturned the results of the election, she wrote to her brother to ask that he send her all the pamphlets and papers that have been printed of your writing. She decided to make a study of politics. In 1766, Parliament repealed the Stamp Act. "The repeal has hushed into silence almost every popular clamor and composed every wave of popular disorder into a smooth and peaceful calm," John Adams wrote in his diary. "I congratulate you and my countrymen on the repeal," Franklin wrote to his sister. The week after the news reached Boston, its town meeting voted in favor of the total abolishing of slavery from among us. Pamphleteers began arguing for a colony-wide anti-slavery law. Others counseled waiting until the end of the battle with Parliament, because even as it repealed the Stamp Act, Parliament had passed the Declaratory Act, asserting its authority to make laws in all cases whatsoever. The next year, Parliament passed the Townshend Acts, taxes on lead, paper, paint, glass, and tea. When this, too, led to riots and boycotts, the Prime Minister sent to Boston two regiments of the British Army to enforce the law. "The whole conversation of this place turns upon politics," Jane reported to her brother. The Boston town meeting resolved that a series of occurrences afford great reason to believe that a deep-laid and desperate plan of imperial despotism has been laid and partly executed for the extinction of all civil liberty. When troops fired into a crowd in March 1770, killing five men, the Sons of Liberty called it a massacre and cried for relief from the tyranny of a standing army. But on the islands, planters called not for less military presence, but more. the colonial assembly on St. Kitts begging the king to send troops over to protect the colonists from the turbulent and savage dispositions of the Negroes ever prone to riots and rebellions. And still, the zeal for liberty raised the question of ending slavery. The Worcester Town Meeting called for a law prohibiting the importing and buying of slaves. By 1766, an anti-slavery bill had been introduced into the Massachusetts Assembly. But, mindful of how the question of slavery had severed the island colonies from the mainland, many in Massachusetts feared that further anti-slavery sentiment would sever the northern colonies from the southern. "If passed into an act, it should have a bad effect on the union of the colonies," one assemblyman wrote to John Adams in 1771 when the bill came up for a vote. The next year, the Court of King's Bench in London took up a case of Somerset versus Stuart. Charles Stuart, a British customs officer in Boston, had purchased an African man named James Somerset. When Stuart was recalled to England in 1769, he brought Somerset with him. Somerset escaped, but was recaptured. Stuart, deciding to sell him to Jamaica, had him imprisoned on a ship. Somerset's friends brought the case to court, where the justice, Lord Mansfield, found that nothing in English common law supported Stuart's position. Somerset was set free. The Somerset case taught people held in slavery two lessons. First, they might look to the courts to secure their freedom. And second, they had a better shot at winning it in Britain than in any of its colonies. They began to act. Relying on the same logic that James Otis Jr. had expounded, they petitioned the courts for their freedom. "We expect great things from men who have made such a noble stand against the designs of their fellow men to enslave them," read a petition filed by four black men in Boston in April 1773. And they tried to escape to England. In Virginia that September, a slave couple ran away hoping to secure their freedom by reaching London, holding, as one observer put it, a notion now too prevalent among the Negroes. This struggle for liberty was lost as the colonists returned instead to their battles with Parliament. The London-based East India Company was at risk of bankruptcy, partly due to the colonial boycott, but more due to a famine in Bengal. The military costs it incurred there, and collapsing stock value, consequent to the empire-wide credit crash of 1772. In May of 1773, Parliament passed the Tea Act, which reduced the tax on tea as a way of saving the East India Company, but again asserted Parliament's right to tax the colonies. Townspeople in Philadelphia called anyone who imported the tea an enemy of the country. Tea agents resigned from their posts in fear. That fall, three ships loaded with tea arrived in Boston. On the night of December 16th, dozens of colonists disguised as Mohawks, warring Indians, boarded the boats and dumped chests of tea into the harbor. To punish the city, Parliament passed the Coercive Acts, which closed Boston Harbor and annulled the Massachusetts Charter, effective in June of 1774. In Virginia, James Madison, Jr., 23, eyed the events in Massachusetts from Montpelier, his family's plantation in the Piedmont, east of the Blue Ridge Mountains. He'd graduated from Princeton 2 years before and was home tutoring his younger siblings. Far from the scene of action, he followed the news avidly and took pains to understand why the response to the tea tax was different in the northern and middle colonies than in the southern colonies. At Princeton, a Presbyterian college, a college of a dissenting faith, he'd made a study of religious liberty. And after the dumping of the tea, he concluded that Massachusetts and Pennsylvania had resisted parliamentary authority in a way that Virginia did not, because the more northern colonies had no established religion. Religious liberty, Madison came to believe, is a good in itself, because it promotes an independence of the mind, but also because it makes possible political liberty. Hearing word of the Coercive Acts, he began to think, for the first time, of war. He wrote to his closest friend, William Bradford, in Philadelphia, and asked him whether it might not be best, as soon as possible, to begin our defense. Meanwhile, at Mount Vernon, George Washington, who'd been elected to the Virginia legislature in 1758, had chiefly occupied himself managing his considerable tobacco estate. He hadn't been much animated by the colony's growing resistance to parliamentary authority until the passage of the Coercive Acts. In September, 56 delegates from 12 of the 13 mainland colonies met in Philadelphia in a Carpenters Guild Hall as the First Continental Congress. Washington served as a delegate from Virginia. But if protest over the Stamp Act had temporarily united the colonies, the Coercive Acts appeared to many delegates to be merely Massachusetts' problem. To Virginians, the delegates from Massachusetts seemed intemperate and rash, fanatical even, especially when they suggested the possibility of an eventual independence from Britain. In October, Washington expressed relief when, after speaking to the Boston people, he felt confident that he could announce it as a fact that it is not the wish or interest of that government or any other upon this continent, separately or collectively, to set up for independency. He was as sure as I can be of my existence that no such thing is desired by any thinking man in all North America. From Philadelphia, James Madison's friend William Bradford passed along fascinating tidbits of gossip about the goings-on at Congress. Bradford proved a resourceful reporter and a better sleuth. From the librarian at the Library Company of Philadelphia, which supplied Congress with books, he'd heard that the delegates were busy reading Vattel, Burlamaqui, Locke, and Montesquieu, leading Bradford to reassure Madison, "We may conjecture that their measures will be wisely planned, since they debate them like philosophers." Wise they may have been, but these philosophers immediately confronted a very difficult question that has dogged the Union ever since. Congress was meant to be a representative body. How would representation be calculated? Virginia delegate Patrick Henry, an irresistible orator with a blistering stare, suggested that delegates cast a number of votes proportionate to their colony's number of white inhabitants. Given the absence of any accurate population figures, the delegates had little choice but to do something far simpler, to grant each colony one vote. In any case, the point of meeting was to become something more than a collection of colonies and the sum of their grievances, a new body politic. "The distinction between Virginians, Pennsylvanians, New Yorkers, and New Englanders is no more," Henry said. "I am not a Virginian, but an American." A word on a long-ago map had swelled into an idea. 2. The Continental Congress neither suffered the disunion and chaos of the Albany Congress nor undertook the deferential pleading of the Stamp Act Congress. Preparing for the worst, this new, more ambitious, and more expansive Continental Congress urged colonists to muster their militias and stockpile weapons. It also agreed to boycott all British imports and to ban all trade with the West Indies, a severing of ties with the islands. The month the boycott was to begin, the Jamaica Assembly sent a petition to the king with a bow and a curtsy. The Jamaicans began with an assurance that the island had no intention of joining the rebellion. "Weak and feeble as this colony is from its very small number of white inhabitants and its peculiar situation from the encumbrance of more than 200,000 slaves, it cannot be supposed that we now intend, or ever could have intended, resistance to Great Britain," the Jamaicans explained. And yet, they went on, they did agree with the Continental's fundamental grievance, declaring it the first established principle of the Constitution that the people of England have a right to partake and do partake of the legislation of their country. Unmoved, Congress offered Jamaica half-hearted thanks. "We feel the warmest gratitude for your pathetic mediation on our behalf with the Crown." Neither the King nor Parliament proved inclined to reconsider the course of acts. The tax burden against which the colonists were protesting was laughably small, and their righteousness was grating. Lord North, the Prime Minister, commissioned the famed essayist Samuel Johnson to write a response to the Continental Congress's complaints. Plainly, the easiest case to make against the colonists was to charge them with hypocrisy. "In taxation, no tyranny," Johnson asked dryly. "How is it that we hear the loudest yelps for liberty among the drivers of Negroes?" Johnson's opposition to slavery was far more than rhetorical. A free Jamaican, a black man named Francis Barber, was his companion, collaborator, and heir. "To the next insurrection of Negroes in the West Indies," Johnson declared in a toast he offered during the war. But Johnson's charge of hypocrisy amounted to no more than the charge made by Philadelphia Dr. Benjamin Rush the year before. "Where is the difference," Rush wondered, "between the British senator who attempts to enslave his fellow subjects in America by imposing taxes upon them, contrary to law and justice, and the American patriot who reduces his African brethren to slavery, contrary to justice and humanity?" By now, the seed planted by Benjamin Lay had borne fruit, and Quakers had formally banned slavery, excluding from membership anyone who claimed to own another human being. On April 14, 1775, 1 month before the Second Continental Congress was to meet in Philadelphia, 24 men, 17 of them Quakers, founded in that city the Society for the Relief of Free Negroes Unlawfully Held in Bondage. But once again, as in 1773, whatever the urgency of ending slavery, the attention of all the colonies was called away. 5 days later, on April 19, 1775, blood spilled on the damp, dark grass of spring on Lexington Green. It began when General Thomas Gage, in charge of the British troops, seized ammunition stored outside of Boston, in nearby Charlestown and Cambridge, and sent 700 soldiers to do the same in Lexington and Concord. 70 armed militiamen, or minutemen, farmers who pledged to be ready at a moment's notice, met them in Lexington and more in Concord. The British soldiers killed 10 of them and lost 2 men of their own. The rebel forces then laid siege to Boston, occupied by the British army. Loyalists stayed in the city, but loyalists in Boston were few. 12,000 of the city's 15,000 inhabitants attempted to escape, the ragged and the dainty, the old and the young, the war's first refugees. John Hancock, John Adams, and Samuel Adams rode in haste to Philadelphia. The evacuation cleaved families. Boston Gazette printer Benjamin Eads carted his printing press and types to the Charles River and rode across, while in Boston his 18-year-old son was taken prisoner of war. Jane Franklin, 63, rode out of the city in a wagon with a granddaughter, leaving a grandson behind. "I had got packed up what I expected to have liberty to carry out, intending to seek my fortune with hundreds others, not knowing whither," she wrote to her brother, who was on his way back to America after years in England to join Congress. Shots having been fired, the debate at the Second Continental Congress, which convened that May, was far more urgent than at the first. Those who continued to hope for reconciliation with Great Britain, which described most delegates, had now to answer the aggrieved, more radical delegates from Massachusetts, who brought stories of trials and tribulations. "I sympathize most sincerely with you and the people of my native town and country," Benjamin Franklin wrote to his sister. "Your account of the distresses attending their removal affects me greatly." In June, 2 months after bullets were first fired in Massachusetts, Congress voted to establish a Continental Army. John Adams nominated George Washington as commander. The resolute and nearly universally admired Washington, a man of unmatched bearing and very much a Virginian, was sent to Massachusetts to take command, his very ride meant as a symbol of the union between North and South. All fall, Congress was occupied with taking up the work of war, raising recruits and provisioning the troops. The question of declaring independence was put off. Most colonists remained loyal to the king. If they supported resistance, it was to fight for their rights as Englishmen, not for their independence as Americans. Their slaves, though, fought a different fight. "It is imagined our governor has been tampering with the slaves and that he has it in contemplation to make great use of them in case of civil war," young James Madison reported from Virginia to his friend William Bradford in Philadelphia. Lord Dunmore, the royal governor of Virginia, intended to offer freedom to slaves who would join the British army. "To say the truth, that is the only part in which this colony is vulnerable," Madison admitted. "And if we should be subdued, we shall fall like Achilles by the hand of one that knows that secret." But the colonists' vulnerability to slave rebellion, that Achilles' heel, was hardly a secret. It defined them. Madison's own grandfather, Ambrose Madison, who'd first settled Montpelier, had been murdered by slaves in 1732, apparently poisoned to death when he was 36. In Madison's county, slaves had been convicted of poisoning their masters again in 1737 and 1746. In the first case, the convicted man was decapitated, his head placed atop a pole outside the courthouse to deter others from doing the like. In the second, a woman named Eve was burned alive. Their bodies were made into monuments. No estate was without this Achilles' heel. George Washington's slaves had been running away since at least 1760. At least 47 of them fled at one time or another. In 1763, a 23-year-old man born in Gambia became Washington's property. Washington named him Harry and sent him to work draining a marsh known as the Great Dismal Swamp. In 1771, Harry Washington managed to escape, only to be recaptured. In November 1775, he was grooming his master's horses in the stables at Mount Vernon when Lord Dunmore made the announcement that Madison had feared. He offered freedom to any slaves who would join His Majesty's troops in suppressing the American rebellion. In Cambridge, where George Washington was assembling the Continental Army, he received a report about the slaves at Mount Vernon. "There is not a man of them but would leave us if they believed they could make their escape," Washington's cousin reported that winter, adding, "Liberty is sweet." Harry Washington bided his time, but he would soon join the 500 men who ran from their owners and joined Dunmore's forces, a number that included a man named Ralph, who ran away from Patrick Henry, and 8 of the 27 people owned by Peyton Randolph, who'd served as president of the First Continental Congress.
Edward Rutledge, a member of South Carolina's delegation to the Continental Congress, said that Dunmore's declaration did more effectually work an eternal separation between Great Britain and the colonies than any other expedient which could possibly have been thought of. Not the taxes and the tea, not the shots at Lexington and Concord, not the siege of Boston. Rather, it was this act, Dunmore's offer of freedom to slaves, that tipped the scales in favor of American independence. Not that it ever tipped them definitively. John Adams estimated that about a third of colonists were patriots, a third were loyalists, and a third never really made a decision about independence. Aside from Dunmore's proclamation of freedom to slaves, the strongest impetus for independence came from brooding and tireless Thomas Paine, who'd immigrated to Philadelphia from England in 1774. In January 1776, Paine published an anonymous pamphlet called Common Sense, 47 pages of brisk political argument. "As it is my design to make those that can scarcely read understand," Paine explained, "I shall therefore avoid every literary ornament and put it in language as plain as the alphabet." Members of Congress might have been philosophers reading Locke and Montesquieu, but ordinary Americans read the Bible, Poor Richard's Almanac, and Thomas Paine. Paine wrote with fury, and he wrote with flash. "The cause of America is in great measure the cause of all mankind," he announced. "'Tis not the affair of a city, a country, a province, or a kingdom, but of a continent, of at least one-eighth part of the habitable globe. 'Tis not the concern of a day, a year, or an age. Posterity are virtually involved in the contest, and will be more or less affected, even to the end of time." His empiricism was homegrown, his metaphors those of the kitchen and the barnyard. "There is something absurd in supposing a continent to be perpetually governed by an island," he wrote, turning the logic of English imperialism on its head. "We may as well assert that because a child has thrived upon milk, that it is to never have meat." But he was not without philosophy. Digesting Locke for everyday readers, Paine explained the idea of a state of nature. Mankind being originally equals in the order of creation, the equality could only be destroyed by some subsequent circumstance, he wrote, a schoolteacher to his pupils. The rule of some over others, the distinction between rich and poor, those forms of equality were not natural, nor were they prescribed by religion. They were the consequences of actions and customs. And the most unnatural distinction of all, he explained, is the distinction of men into kings and subjects. Paine made use, too, of Magna Carta, arguing, "The charter which secures this freedom in England was formed not in the Senate but in the field, and insisted upon by the people, not granted by the crown." He urged Americans to write their own Magna Carta. But Magna Carta supplies no justification for outright rebellion. The best and most expedient strategy, Paine understood, was to argue not from precedent or doctrine, but from nature, to insist that there exists a natural right to revolution, as natural as a child leaving a parent. Let us suppose a small number of persons settled in some sequestered part of the earth, unconnected with the rest. They will then represent the first peopling of any country or of the world, he began, as if he were telling a child a once-upon-a-time story. They will erect a government to secure their safety and their liberty, and when that government ceases to secure their safety and their liberty, it stands to reason that they may depose it. They retain this right forever. Much the same language found its way into resolutions passed by specially established colonial conventions, held so that the colonies, untethered from Britain, could establish new forms of government. "All men are by nature equally free and independent and have certain inherent rights of which, when they enter into a state of society, they cannot, by any compact, deprive or divest their posterity," read the Virginia Declaration of Rights and Form of Government, drafted in May 1776 by brazen George Mason. "All power is vested in and consequently derived from the people." James Madison, half Mason's age, had been elected to the convention from Orange County. He proposed a revision to Mason's declaration. Where Mason had written that all men should enjoy the fullest toleration in the exercise of religion, Madison rewrote that clause to instead guarantee that all men are equally entitled to the free and full exercise of it. The proposed change was adopted, and Madison became the author of the first ever constitutional guarantee of religious liberty, not as something to be tolerated, but as a fundamental right. Inevitably, slavery cast its long and terrible shadow over these statements of principle. Slavery, in fact, had made these statements of principle possible.
Mason's original draft hadn't included the clause about rights being acquired by men when they enter into a state of society. These words were added after members of the convention worried that the original would have the effect of abolishing slavery. If all men belonging to civil society are free and equal, how can slavery be possible? It must be, Virginia's convention answered, that